We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Inspiring words from our Declaration of Independence, but are they quite so inspiring when I emphasize a different word, that all men are created equal? As my wife often reminds me, women are often the last people at the table in the struggle for civil rights and equality in this country. But today we're going to talk about another woman who made sure that they weren't forgotten. Her name was Pauli Murray, and while most people were fighting Jim Crow, she was leading the charge against Jane Crow. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's all about Pauli Murray and a new book called Jane Crow.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
We've done a number of episodes on this show about women's rights, about women's equality, women's suffrage, the Equal Rights Amendment that was proposed back in the 1970s. And so it's with some embarrassment that I must admit something to you. I was completely unfamiliar with one of the more important figures in the struggle for women's equality. Her name was Pauli Murray, and up until recently, I'd never heard of her. Fortunately, Rosalind Rosenberg, a historian from Barnard College, has recently written a biography of Pauli Murray, and she calls it Jane Crow, because that's what Pauli Murray fought against. Here's Rosalind Rosenberg.
I have taught American history with an emphasis on women's history and legal history since the mid-1970s. And I came to be interested in Pauli Murray first in the 1970s because one of the first colleagues I met at Columbia was a young professor at Columbia Law School by the name of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Oh, my.
As a young scholar and a feminist, I was fascinated, wowed by this amazing woman who was arguing cases before the Supreme Court, attempting to extend the reach of the Equal Protection Clause to cover women. And for all the time that Ruth remained at Columbia until the late 70s, she patiently answered questions. So my initial interest was in the 14th Amendment, but I was also interested in Pauli Murray because she was one of the leaders of the civil rights and feminist movement of that time, and I read articles and collected works in the feminist movement then. Yeah. But I really became interested in her after reading her memoir, which was called Song in a Weary Throat.
Well, that's a great title, Song in a Weary Throat. Before we get to that, and I really want to get to this because, as I've mentioned to you, I was ignorant of Pauli Murray, and I'm ashamed of my ignorance, and I'm just so glad that you're going to remedy that for us here in a moment. But you've said several things that I just have to remark on. First of all, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, wow. I mean, quite a colleague to have, just remarkable. Another thing you've said is the 14th Amendment. And let's just pause for a moment and give a little bit of constitutional background. The 14th Amendment was passed right after, during Reconstruction, right after the Civil War. It was the first time that the word equality was mentioned in the Constitution. It's such a major change from the pre-Civil War Constitution, which protected slavery, 180-degree turn, that many scholars will refer to this as a second American founding. And yet, as profound a change as the 14th Amendment made in our constitutional law, it was restricted in its scope by the Supreme Court, and specifically, it was not considered to apply to women. And so when you referenced a moment ago that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Pauli Murray were trying to get that to apply to women, that was something that had been on the agenda for a long time but had not met with any success as of the 1970s. Isn't that correct?
That's certainly true. Feminists tried at the period in which the Civil War amendments were passed to include women among those who would be granted equal protection, but they failed. So it was really a century-long effort to extend equality of rights to women.
We've done several episodes on women's suffrage, and many women have pointed that out to me, that the women's suffrage movement, the women's equality movement, really tried to hook into the civil rights movement broadly defined, anti-slavery and then ultimately civil rights, and that they were rebuffed at every opportunity. And when I mention these things to my wife, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, voting rights, she will always add, yeah, voting rights for men. And I once made the mistake of saying, well, you know, not every minority group is going to get relief at the same time. And she'll say, we're not the minority, we're the majority. So my gosh, I have been hearing this from my female friends and relatives for many, many years. But it's important for us to remember that women really were, in some sense, the last of the major groups in society to achieve legal equality.
That's right. That's right.
So a big, big struggle. It's been going on for a century or more. It's the 1970s. You have the great good fortune of being at Columbia when Ruth Bader Ginsburg is there. And is she the first person who told you about Pauli Murray, or did you know about Pauli Murray through your own studies?
I can't really remember, because certainly I was, I read everything that I could at the time, all of the essays that were being collected at that time. And I read Pauli Murray's essay called Jim Crow and Jane Crow in historian Gerda Lerner's collection on Black women in white America. So it's, my memory is not good enough to be able to specify exactly where I first heard her name. There was also a Columbia graduate student who was writing her dissertation on the President's Commission on the Status of Women, that is John F. Kennedy's commission, mm-hmm. and Pauli Murray played a role there. So I was aware of that. But certainly in the 1970s, I knew who Pauli Murray was. I didn't realize how creative she was, how pivotal she was, how central she was to the intersection of the civil rights and the women's movement of that period.
If I may suggest, then, Rosalind, why don't we start at the beginning? Who was she? When was she born? Where did she come from?
Pauli Murray was born in 1910 in Baltimore to a middle-class Episcopalian Black family. I know that in one of your earlier shows, you spoke to Elizabeth Dowling Taylor about her book, The Original Black Elite, a biography of Daniel Murray. And I thought at a time that perhaps the Murrays were related to Daniel Murray. Certainly the Murray family in Baltimore and Washington was very prominent. But eventually I realized in looking through Pauli Murray's papers that her paternal grandfather had been a slave and had chosen the name Murray when he was emancipated with others in 1865 as a way of sort of defining his future as a successful person. So he it's a little bit how, you know, some people would name their children Franklin Roosevelt. He wanted to be a Murray. So there's no relationship with the prominent Murrays, but certainly the family was middle class. But Pauli was orphaned at the age of three. Her mother died suddenly of a stroke, and her father was institutionalized soon thereafter as mentally ill. She was raised in Durham, North Carolina, by her maternal grandparents and her aunts who adopted her. Her namesake, Aunt Pauline Fitzgerald, adopted her, and that's where she grew up, in North Carolina. One of the things that is, I think, very important about Pauli Murray is that from very early in her childhood, she identified as a boy. In fact, Aunt Pauline called her boy girl. And when Aunt Pauline went to buy clothes for Pauli, Pauli insisted that she not buy dresses. She insisted on going to the boys' department and buy boys' clothes. The neighbors laughed, but Aunt Pauline let Pauli wear whatever she wanted, except at church. She drew the line at church. She could not wear boys' clothes to church. But other days, Pauli wore boys' clothes, and she engaged in boys' activities, and she thought of herself as a boy.
And this is in the 19-teens.
That's right.
That was not something that was generally accepted. In fact, there's a term that is almost anachronistic now. You rarely hear it used anymore, but we used to refer to such girls as tomboys. When I was growing up in the 1960s, and there just wasn't nearly as much knowledge back then about gender identity issues, was there?
There wasn't, and there wasn't the language. But she took it further. Tomboy is a broader term for girls who like to dress as boys and to not conform to traditional gender expectations. But when Pauli Murray grew up, she decided that she was more than a tomboy, that she, I think that if she were living today, she would probably embrace the label of being a trans man. She tried to persuade doctors to give her testosterone for many years, for two decades, and they wouldn't. She read everything that she could find on the writings on sexuality, and she read a book that persuaded her she was a pseudo-hermaphrodite, which is to say, she was a person whose outward gender was different from her internal sex organs. Pauli Murray was convinced that she had secreted male genitalia, and she sought doctors to prove that she was right. She had x-rays. They didn't show anything. Mm-hmm. When she had an appendectomy, she asked the surgeon to look for secreted genitalia, and he didn't find anything. But she was convinced that she was at least partially male, and she felt psychologically male. And it's something that hasn't been written about before, in part because until fairly recently, to be transgender was so stigmatized in our society that it was something that Pauli Murray never publicly admitted to, and it's something that she talked with even intimate friends on only rare occasions. And generally, if she did, she was dismissed as being, oh, no, no, you mean you're a lesbian? Or more commonly, oh, that's ridiculous. So this was a part of her identity that I think was tremendously important, because just as she had a mixed race background, her aunts could pass for white, she also had a mixed class background. She was born into a family that was educated, but she grew up very poor. It meant that she experienced the world as having an in-between status that made her more critical of conventional views, particularly when it came to constitutional law, than otherwise would have been the case.
She seemed to have had a number of traits that put her at one disadvantage after another. I mean, she was a woman. Women were disadvantaged. She was black. Black people were very disadvantaged, of course. And then on top of that, she had gender identity issues, which weren't even acknowledged back in the day. So the woman just seemed to have one difficulty after another.
And one would think that it would have crippled her.
Yeah.
To me, that's one of the most surprising things about her. I don't mean to say that these various areas in which she was discriminated against weren't a problem for her. They were a tremendous problem. And one of the things one sees is reading through her private papers, which are at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard, is that the various tensions in her life caused her no end of grief and turmoil. She was hospitalized a number of times in periods of crisis over her identity. But at the same time, that very sense of being in between, of not being a member of any fixed category, made her an early skeptic of classifications she viewed as arbitrary. Race being one, gender being another. And I think it was because of the in-betweenness that she felt that she was able to see what other people couldn't see in her time.
Yeah, I think people who themselves have suffered discrimination might be much more empathetic towards others. And as we just said, Pauli had suffered discrimination from several different directions. It would make sense she would be much more empathetic in much more different ways than other people might be.
Empathetic, but also fierce.
Oh, yes, yes.
In resisting what she saw as arbitrary discrimination. She, having grown up in the segregated system of the South, and I think it's important to remember that after a period of relative openness and freedom after the Civil War, the period when Pauli Murray was born, 1910, was really the nadir of the civil rights movement, and one in which she grew up in a system of Jim Crow that her grandparents and parents had not known in the 1870s and 80s. So she grew up with people who remembered a better time and who educated her to resist these laws that were being passed when she was born. When she graduated from high school, she insisted on going to New York to school. And of course, this was a period of the beginning of the Great Migration, so she was hardly alone. Her aunt Pauline, her adoptive mother, was very sad about this, but supported it. And Pauline ended up going to Hunter College, which really changed her life by giving her an education she could not have had in North Carolina at that time, and exposed her to ideas that supported her in her resistance to discrimination. Her favorite course was one in anthropology by a student of Franz Boas and Ruth Benedict. So she gained in college support for the idea that race was an arbitrary category and shaped as much by culture as anything else.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Rosalind Rosenberg, who's written a really compelling new biography. It's about a woman named Polly Murray, and it's called Jane Crow. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Rosalind Rosenberg. Stick around. Doug Smith, how the heck are you today?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. We're at Montpelier. It's every day's a pretty day at Montpelier.
Every day is beautiful.
It is absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. I was looking at the duck pond. It actually has ducks on it.
It does. It does. So many amazing things are happening here at Montpelier. The property looks gorgeous.
It does.
And the house is just beaming with Madison-ness.
In fact, didn't you just recently change what was the old library into a bedchamber?
It was. So that room would have been different things throughout the time of the Madison. But
right.
The way that Montpelier is interpreting that room now is partially as a bedchamber, as it was used at times during
right.
Madison's life.
Especially toward the end of it, right? Dolly was downstairs and James was in another room, which was right next to it. Which makes sense, but I have to say that when I saw that, it made me heart hurt a little bit because that had to be among my favorite rooms there. I like that as a library.
Oh, right. Well, every room is gorgeous.
Every room is gorgeous. Every room is gorgeous. And I'm not going to argue with the historians. But anyway, we're doing quizzes, so do you have a quiz?
I do. I've got a question here, and I think it's very relevant.
Very relevant. Mm-hmm. Well, let's see if we have a contestant. Anybody on the line?
Yes, my name is Derek, and I'm calling from Anderson, South Carolina.
Anderson, South Carolina. And Dan, how do you listen to the show, Derek?
I usually listen to the show on my iPhone with the podcast app.
Oh,
a lot of time on the road, so it's a good way to pass the time as I'm driving down the highway.
Well, Eric, we're very happy to have you with us, and we thank you for volunteering via our Facebook page. And I'll just encourage people to find us on Facebook and to like us, and in the future they can be contestants too. But right now, let's go to the quiz. Doug, what do you got for Derek?
All right, Derek, I've got a question with only two answers. Two choices.
Okay.
And
All right.
I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to let you decide which one it is. Are you ready?
Okay.
Does the U.S. Constitution protect American citizens from waterboarding?
Mm.
Does the U.S. Constitution protect American citizens from waterboarding? Is it A, yes, the Eighth Amendment forbids cruel and unusual punishment, or is it B, no, waterboarding does not meet the standard of torture?
Hmm.
Well, that's interesting because I think that's, it seems like that would be a matter of interpretation of whether or not it is deemed to be torture.
I can't help you on this one, Derek. I've never been waterboarded. I'm glad of that.
That's probably a good thing.
Yes.
I'm going to go with no, because I'm going to guess that matter's not exactly settled.
Not settled under constitutional law, Doug.
Well, you know, I should have added a third choice, a C.
Uh-huh.
And he would be right as the third choice of C. I would say, A, yes, the Eighth Amendment forbids cruel and unusual punishment.
Which I knew that was correct, but I didn't know because waterboarding specifically...
Hey, but he's got a great point. The key here is citizens.
Right.
The key here is citizens. Because we know the U.S. government has used waterboarding in the past, but not on U.S. citizens that I'm aware of.
Not that I'm aware of either, but I think actually Derek probably has the best answer to this. I'm looking at the Eighth Amendment right now in my pocket constitution. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. That's the passive voice. Arguably, that could be applied to citizens and or non-citizens. I mean, you could interpret it a number of different ways. I'm not aware of waterboarding being used on U.S. citizens as a punishment in a court case, and I think it probably would be declared an Eighth Amendment violation were it used. But the issue's arisen overseas, and it's arisen in the context of treaty interpretation.
Well, in fact, there has been cases during the Bush administration where extradition was happening to other countries specifically for interrogation techniques that couldn't have happened on U.S. soil.
Right. Well, I'm going to agree with you, Doug, that I think it would be an Eighth Amendment violation. I'm not aware of any case specifically holding that, so I think let's give Derek credit for that.
Oh, I think so.
Yeah, I think that's a good answer because it really probably hasn't been decided, though I think Doug's probably right ultimately in how it would be decided. So congratulations to you, Derek. We'll send you a T-shirt.
All right. I will take it.
So send us a message on Facebook and give us your T-shirt size and your mailing address, and we'll send the T-shirt and your pocket constitution.
All right. Well, I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Derek. And thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Hey, it's the Constitution. We read it for the articles.
Pauli Murray is an accomplished human rights activist, historian, attorney, poet, and teacher who believed in justice, reconciliation, and freedom. Pauli Murray dedicated her life to challenging discrimination of all forms and is one of the most pivotal figures in 20th century civil rights history. No woman was more important than Pauli Murray in integrating civil rights and women's rights. She spent much of her life breaking down the barriers of race and gender in the fight for equality. As a civil rights activist and a vanguard for racial equality, her work paved the way and tested boundaries for Rosa Parks, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and other civil rights leaders to follow. She also paved the way for women to attend collegiate institutions that did not previously admit women or African Americans. This extraordinary woman refused to see herself restricted by the categories of gender, race, class, and sexuality. She tested boundaries and fought to make sure that women's voices were heard. She has proved that everyone has potential for action. Murray's ideas, arguments, strategies, and powerful writing still resonate with issues of today.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with Rosalind Rosenberg, an emerita professor of history from Barnard College. And Rosalind has written a new biography of a woman perhaps you've never heard of. Her name was Pauli Murray, and she was a real pioneer, primarily in women's rights. But she was also African American, and it turns out, at least we think, she was also transgender. Wow, talk about a person who faced discrimination from every direction. Indeed, she faced discrimination from an early age, starting with her attempts simply to get educated.
So she graduated from Hunter, and she tried to get some graduate school as well, but she encountered some difficulty there, didn't she?
Well, Aunt Pauline always wanted her to come home to take care of her aunt as she grew older. And so Pauline thought, well, all right, what I'll do is I'll go to the University of North Carolina, not put off by the fact that the University of North Carolina had never accepted a black student for admission, much less graduate study. But she applied anyway and was turned down because of her race, which infuriated her in particular because her great-great-grandfather had been a trustee of the University of North Carolina. And much of that family's money had gone to provide scholarships for students at North Carolina, which she thought she ought to be able to claim.
That is really striking when your granddad or great-grandfather is a trustee of a place, and normally that would give you a legacy advantage in admissions. It didn't seem to have worked for her.
No, it did not. It did not.
My.
So she carried out this campaign of education. She certainly did not accept the fact that she had been rejected. She protested. She liked to say that one woman in a typewriter could make a movement. And so in a tiny room in Harlem with her typewriter, she pounded out these letters of protest to what had happened and began to raised the consciousness of students, white students at the University of North Carolina, many of whom in sociology supported her being admitted. But it wasn't another two decades before the University of North Carolina began to admit African-American students.
Mm. So what did Pauli do then?
She joined the labor movement. She worked for the Workers' Defense League and taught classes in various labor unions, and just worked at a series of jobs, basically doing administrative work for very low pay, until she decided that she wanted to go to law school. And she ended up at Howard Law School. She was the only woman student in her class. She also graduated first.
Oh, really?
But she graduated.
Well, I guess she showed them.
Well, she, and as a matter of fact, she did. She, on the first day of class, one of the professors joked that he didn't know why there was a woman in the class, but since she was there, they were going to have to put up with her, and all the male students laughed, and Pauli gritted her teeth and vowed that she'd show them. So she did. She graduated first in her class.
Now, here's where I have to interrupt, Rosalind. I know that I shouldn't hold any group of people to any higher standard than any other, but it always strikes me as such an irony. There they are at Howard University. That's a historically black college. It's founded because of discrimination against black people, and yet the people at Howard turn right around and discriminate against her just because she's a woman.
Well, and that, going back to your earlier point, is I think interesting, because being discriminated against can lead one to be more empathetic towards others who are being discriminated against.
One would hope.
On other grounds. But not necessarily. And certainly, yeah. Pauli Murray's experience at Howard was the reverse.
Yeah.
That the very students who were at Howard, because it was a university dedicated to the advancement of black students, and who were at the law school in part because it was the leading site of preparation of litigators for civil rights cases, didn't make them any the more sympathetic to a woman trying to join them. And it was at that moment that Pauli Murray coined the phrase Jane Crow, because her male classmates were very mindful of the evils of Jim Crow, but couldn't see Jane Crow facing them in the same classroom.
Isn't that astonishing? I was at college in the 1980s, and I remember studying the civil rights movement, and I can't attribute this quote precisely, and I'm not entirely certain of if I'm getting exactly right, but there was a civil rights leader, a prominent civil rights leader, who was asked about the role of women in the civil rights movement, and his response was pithy. He said, "The only position for women in our movement is prone."
Yes, yes.
And,
well,
and I was just struck by that. I mean, you know, but it's just really true. Even if you yourself are discriminated against, I mean, we're all human beings and we all have these tendencies. And, you know, I guess it would be nice, wouldn't it, if we could empathize with one another more than we do. But please go on.
Well, Pauli dedicated her life to trying to get beyond those kinds of discriminations. She graduated from Howard and was called into the office of the dean then, William Hastie, who said, you know, you should apply for a Rosenwald Fellowship and do a postgraduate year at a white law school. Because that's what you need to do to be what you want to be. And Pauli decided she wanted to be a law school professor.
Hmm.
So she applied for the Rosenwald. And one of the questions on the applications was what she wanted to do with it. She wanted to do a legal study in race and labor law at Harvard. Because that's where the person who graduated first in the class at Howard typically went. But of course, everyone who had graduated first in the class up until then had been male. Mm-hmm. And she didn't realize at the time that Harvard Law School didn't admit women. So she applied, and she was told that she couldn't be admitted because she was a woman. And just as she had protested her exclusion from UNC because of her race, she protested her exclusion from Harvard on the basis of gender. And she wrote in a very telling phrase, dear sirs, are you telling me that it's going to be as difficult to change your mind as it would be for me to change my sex? You know, I would gladly change my sex if I could. And this was the time when she was trying to persuade doctors to give her testosterone, because she was convinced that if only she could have a lower voice, and if only if her outer characteristics could more closely resemble the male she felt within, that life would be better. So I've always thought that this notion that I would gladly change my sex if I could was the most public declaration she ever made about the inner struggle that she experienced. Mm-hmm. So she didn't go to Harvard. She ended up at the University of California, what was then known as Bolt Hall, the law school at UNC. Mm-hmm. And it was there that she wrote the early papers that became the basis for her later work, arguing that gender is analogous to race, and that both are arbitrary categories and should be not used as a basis for discriminating against either African Americans or women.
So that takes us up to, I'm guessing here, roughly 1940.
She graduated from Howard in 1944 and from Bolt Hall a year and a half later. Okay. She became an assistant attorney general in California, mm-hmm. certainly the first black woman, I think the first black person to hold that position. But this was at the end of the war. And as men began coming back from military service, she lost that job. And that was a common story for women in World War II, mm-hmm. who were able to find jobs when men were in military service but lost those jobs. So she ended up moving back to New York and worked in a series of jobs as she tried to pass the New York bar. And she had tremendous difficulty. One of the things I did in researching the book was to track down her application for admission to the bar in New York. And when I found it, there was some reluctance in letting me see it. It's not typically done, but I was able to get it. It's the largest application that had ever been submitted in New York, I think to this day. And it spoke to two things. One was that in order to be admitted to the bar, you needed to be able to identify where you had every place you'd ever lived, every job you had ever held. And Polly Murray was a poor black woman. She changed apartment rooms every year, sometimes every 6 months, because her typing got her evicted.
Really?
Yes.
So, oh, my gosh. Just a minute here. That really strikes a chord. I remember, people listening now, especially younger people, won't be that familiar with typewriters, but I recall having gotten into trouble with a fellow in my dormitory in college because I waited too long to finish a paper. It was 2 a.m. and I was typing, and somebody came and knocked on my door and said, would you knock it off? So that was getting her evicted. And I guess I can understand that. And also, you mentioned the bar exams, bar applications. I've had to fill out several of those over the years, moving from state to state. And you're right. They still require you to tell every single place you've ever been and every job you've had. And that was hard enough for people like me. But if she's changing jobs, what, every year, you said?
Yes.
Every 6 months. Oh, my gosh. Oh, that must have been a thick application.
But that wasn't the worst of it. The worst of it This was now 1948. The worst of it was that she had to identify every organization she'd ever belonged to.
Uh-oh. Labor organizations, left wing?
That's right.
Oh, boy.
And she had belonged in particular to the Communist Party opposition, which was an American group. She belonged only for a year. She resigned because she resented being told who she had to vote for. But she was a young radical. And in 1945 in California, that wasn't a problem. In 1948 in New York, it was a major problem. And she almost didn't get admitted to the bar because of those early radical associations. But she finally did. And then she had a lot of trouble finding work because this was the period of McCarthyism. She was Black. She was female. She had a history of belonging to radical organizations. She really had a hard time supporting herself, and in the end gave up on legal practice for a number of years and wrote her first family memoir called Proud Shoes, which was a history of her grandparents, particularly her maternal grandfather, who had served in the Army and in the Navy in the Civil War, but had been denied pension, even though he had suffered a war injury that eventually made him blind.
Oh, my.
She wrote about her family as the real Americans, you know, the Americans who represented the diversity of American life. She was proud of being a Indian American, because she had Cherokee Indian heritage as well. And it's a wonderful book. It's just a beautiful book. But that's what she did in the 1950s.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about a new biography. It's called Jane Crow. Isn't that a great title? It's written by a retired history professor. Her name is Rosalind Rosenberg, and the subject of the biography is Pauli Murray. A fascinating, fascinating woman. After the break, we'll come back and finish our discussion with Rosalind Rosenberg. Stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish our fascinating discussion with Rosalind Rosenberg, an emeritus professor of history from Barnard College. She's telling us all about her new biography of Pauli Murray, a book called Jane Crow. Was she able to find any legal position at all as a young attorney in New York?
She found a job, as women sometimes did, in the back office where no one saw they were there. Mm-hmm. So she did some of that. She finally realized that if she was going to get work, she was going to have to get it herself. So she was a solo practitioner for several years. But the only clients she could get were Black women who were poorer than she was. And so she represented women, but she very often was not paid because they didn't have the money to pay her.
You know, that's one of the terrible ironies of the practice of law, is there is a lot of need out there. But most of the people who need legal services really can't afford to pay enough so that attorneys can make a living off of them. And so who do attorneys work for? They work for corporations and banks and rich individuals. And of course, in order to get those sorts of clients, you either have to be accepted into an established firm, or you have to have connections, or you have to work for a long time to make a reputation before they'll hire you. And which of these rich people and which of these corporations are going to hire a Black woman? In the 1950s.
Pauli had one really important connection, and that was the great-grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, the firebrand abolitionist from antebellum days, who fought not only against slavery and freedom for blacks, but also for equality for women. And his great-great-grandson, Lloyd Garrison, was a liberal. He was at Howard Law School as a trustee and met Pauli Murray there, liked her, and became her advocate. And finally was able to get her a job in the library at Paul Weiss, a very distinguished New York liberal law firm, in 1956. And Pauli was uncertain about taking it. She wanted to be a lawyer. She didn't want to be in the library. But by the time she got there, Garrison had gotten her a position in litigation, which is really incredible because the litigation department was not a place where there were any other women attorneys, much less a black woman attorney. But Pauli made her way there. She never became a partner, but she was respected and kept on as a sort of, as we would say, a senior associate. Mm-hmm. But she wanted to do more. So when she found out that there was a law position at the University of Ghana, she went to Ghana and taught there until her outspokenness almost got her jailed. So,
oh my!
In the course of being in Ghana, she met law professors who were visiting African nations coming to independence in 1960. 61 when she was there, was the major historical event of the day. And so she saw all of the elite professors of American law schools coming through Ghana. And one of them from Yale persuaded her to come back to Yale and to go to graduate school there. So she became the first black woman to earn a graduate degree at Yale Law School. And it's because of that that Yale University has just recently named one of its new residential colleges Pauli Murray College.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's remarkable. Is that the one that they changed from Calhoun College?
No, no, no.
Okay.
That has been named Grace Murray Harper, who was a brilliant early IT person.
Oh, okay, all right. But Pauli Murray got her building too.
She got her Murray, yes.
Okay.
And there's another Murray, another building for Benjamin Franklin.
So okay.
Those are the three new names. So Pauli Murray came back, and she was spent the early 60s at Yale getting her graduate degree in law and hoping to become a law professor. But it was at that point that Eleanor Roosevelt, whom Pauli had known for a long time and had become very close to when Pauli was at Howard Law School and Eleanor Roosevelt was First Lady. There's a wonderful story of their friendship by Patricia Bell Scott called The Firebrand and the First Lady that came out last year that talks about their friendship. But Roosevelt had tremendous respect for Murray and asked her to serve on the John F. Kennedy's President's Commission on the Status of Women in the hope that Murray would be able to break a four-decade-long deadlock between the two main branches of the women's movement in the 20th century. One branch led by the National Woman's Party and Alice Paul wanted to pass an equal rights amendment. Mm-hmm. And the other branch was fearful of that goal because they worried that it would have a bad effect on women workers for whom they felt that the protective labor laws that had been passed during the Progressive period and later, even the playing field for women workers who always held the worst jobs and were paid the least. So you have this battle that's been going on for decades. Pauli Murray suggested a third way to equal rights for women. She told the members of the National Women's Party that the Equal Rights Amendment was too big a gamble, that it was very unlikely it would ever pass because it was controversial and because getting any amendment passed is very hard under our constitutional system. But she also told those who were fearful of the Equal Rights Amendment that the 14th Amendment offered a way of getting equal rights that everyone could agree on without jeopardizing the protective labor laws that progressives had fought so hard to establish and protect. She said, let's just take our cases one at a time. We all agree that women should not be barred from jury service, that that's clearly discriminatory. Let's start with jury cases and move on from there. And that's what the President's Commission agreed to do and what Pauli Murray was able to do by the mid-1960s.
So they simply started knocking. This is very similar, of course, to what the civil rights movement had done with racial discrimination earlier in the century. You know, just pick your targets and knock them off one by one. Everybody tends to think that it was just sort of poof, Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 and 55, but there were several precursor cases that had set the stage, a bunch of litigation, and all pursuant to a strategy. And so Pauli Murray was the person who came up with a strategy for women.
That's right. She said, we need to have a Brown versus Board of Education for women's rights. And she thought that she had found it in a case that came out of Lowndes County, Alabama, a case that was called wonderfully White versus Crook.
A good name. And,
it was a jury case, and it came about because of the murder of two religious figures in Lowndes County right after the Selma March. Many civil rights workers moved into Lowndes County, known as Bloody Lowndes, because it was a particularly oppressive place. There was a young Catholic priest who was working to register voters. There was a young Episcopalian minister who was there as well, and they were killed. And everyone knew who had killed them. It was done in broad daylight, but the a case was brought, but it was dismissed by an all-white, all-male jury. And so the ACLU got involved in the case, and Pauli Murray helped write the brief in the case of White v. Crook, which was decided by an appellate court, and three judges ruled that the Alabama statute that prohibited women from serving on juries was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And that was so exciting. They thought that White v. Crook would go to the Supreme Court, but the Attorney General of Alabama did not want to have his name associated with what he feared would be a losing case, and so he didn't appeal the decision. Pauli Murray went on to inspire Betty Friedan and others to found an NAACP for women, which they called NOW, the National Organization for Women. And she ended up not as a law professor, but as a professor at Brandeis University. And it was from Brandeis that she was able to gain a national presence. She was asked to serve on the board of the ACLU. She was only one of three women on the board of 76 members, but she used her position at Brandeis and the ACLU to advance the argument that she had been making for a long time now, that women should use the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to gain equal rights. And she persuaded Ruth Bader Ginsburg of her view, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg used Murray's argument in the first case in which the Supreme Court ruled that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment covered not only race discrimination, but also sex discrimination. That was the case of Reed v. Reed in 1971, which was an estate administration case, kind of not the sort of case that you would expect to be a landmark, but it was. For the first time, the Supreme Court said that it was not reasonable to classify people on the basis of their gender for purposes of discrimination when the classification bore no relationship to the work being done, that is, to be an estate administrator.
And that was landmark, and there have been many cases since that have followed along those lines. And the struggle continues. Without getting into too much detail, women are not given the same degree of protection as other groups are. It's something called intermediate scrutiny rather than strict scrutiny. And I've spoken to other feminists who are still irritated by that. One in particular I'm thinking of wanted to go the other route. She wanted the Equal Rights Amendment. So there is still debate. There are still issues to be addressed.
Right. I should hasten to add that Pauli Murray eventually supported the Equal Rights Amendment because she was, by the end of the 60s, she didn't think the 14th Amendment strategy was going to work. Mm-hmm. The irony is that the ERA eventually failed in 1982, and it was the 14th Amendment strategy that has gotten men and other groups rights that they would not otherwise have had.
Indeed. Well, just before we leave, that was her great accomplishment. What happened to Pauli Murray later? How did she end up?
She left Brandeis in 1973 after the death of her partner, Irene Barlow, whom she had met at Paul Weiss, and she entered a divinity school to become an Episcopalian priest. And she was one of the first women to be ordained in the Episcopal clergy, and she became the first Black woman to be an Episcopal priest. She was never able to have a church of her own. She was a supply priest, an itinerant priest, but I think in some ways the most meaningful part of her life, because she was serving the poor, particularly poor Black women, and working as much as she could to, through her sense of in-betweenness, to be a bridge between whites and Blacks, between rich and poor, between men and women. She celebrated diversity. She's fought for the rights not just of Blacks and women, but all people she called social minorities. She couldn't bring herself to say gays or lesbians or transsexuals, but that's who she meant. And I think that she paved the way for many of the advances that are being made today. Unfortunately, advances that are under constant assault, but nevertheless advances that I believe will prevail in the end. And I think he deserves to be better known.
Well, Rosalind Rosenberg, thank you very much for talking to us about this remarkable woman, Pauli Murray, that so many of us were not nearly as familiar with as we should be. Once again, what's the name of your book?
Jane Crow, The Life of Pauli Murray.
At your local bookstore and everywhere online. So thank you very much for sharing this with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Emerita Professor of History, Rosalind Rosenberg from Barnard College, who's told us all about her fascinating new biography of Pauli Murray. It's called Jane Crow. Go out and get yourself a copy. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hudsonson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harrison. Remember, you are a part of the American experiment, even if you are African-American and a woman and transgendered.